Hello, and welcome to Sci-Fi. Yes, we are sci-fi, because if you say sci-fi three times into a mirror, Harlan Ellison does not appear in the room behind you.
But a giant sandworm does come out of the ground.
Well, there are downsides to all things.
Ride the spice, baby.
Ride the spice. So today we are discussing Indexing Reflections by Seanan McGuire, which originally was released in 2015 as single episodes and as 2016 as a single book. This is book two in the Indexing series, so that makes it our first technical sequel.
But we never reviewed the first one.
Well, no, we haven't actually talked about it, but there is a prehistory to this, so it's kind of, yeah.
Moving on.
So much editing.
I would just leave it in.
Well, it is true that this is the sequel, but there is a lot of structural overlap.
That's true.
They do make sure that the reader is well-grounded in what happened before at the beginning of this book.
Exactly. I should say at the outset that Seanan McGuire is a friendly acquaintance of mine, so anything that I say can and will be biased in that she might stab me with a knife if I say anything bad.
Is she going to sue us?
I said stab you with a knife, not do something terrible.
I thought you said you.
Yeah. What about
or
the rest of us?
I can't control Seanan McGuire's actions.
So much editing.
And so little. So as ever, we shall start with a short summary.
From the back of the book, Indexing Reflections by Seanan McGuire. The struggle against not-so-charming storybook narratives isn't the only complicating factor in Henrietta Henry Marchand's life. As part of the ATI Management Bureau team protecting the world from fairy tales gone awry, she's juggling her unwanted new status as a Snow White, dealing with a potentially dangerous Pied Piper and wrangling a most troublesome wicked stepsister, along with a budding relationship with Jeff, her teammate. But when a twisted, vicious Cinderella breaks out of the prison and wreaks havoc, things go from disenchanted to deadly, and once Henry realizes someone is trying to use her to destroy the world, her story becomes far from over, and this one might not have a happily ever after.
All right, so what did people think about this? Kevin?
Overall, I liked it, but I will say that there were parts maybe halfway to three-quarters of the way through that started dragging a bit. I think the concept of the whole narrative thing kind of saves it for me. Mm-hmm. In fact, a similar thing happened in the last book, except it was maybe like the last half hour that started dragging.
Okay.
But overall, I enjoyed it.
Barry?
I thought it was a very fun, quick listen for us, I guess. We didn't actually read the book. We consumed it in audiobook format.
I believe that the term read now encompasses audiobooks.
It does for us.
I'm not even sure if I really even read the receipt.
I'm not even sure if you really exist.
I'm not sure I exist either.
Fair enough.
But yeah, like I said, it was a very fun, kind of a light, light listen. It's a lot, very entertaining. Really enjoyed it. I also felt very similarly about the first book in the series as well.
Okay. Yeah, I enjoyed it as well. I'm going to give special props to Mary Robinette Cowell for really working hard on a narration that requires a lot of different voices. There are some aspects of the narration that made her work a lot more difficult. We'll get back into that yes. In the discussion section. This is a fine second book in the series. So now we're going to take a break, and when we be back, we'll be moving on with the discussion section of our series, where we'll get into spoilers.
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 All right, so we're back with Sci-Fi, and this is our discussion section, where we can discuss spoilers to our terrifying heart's content.
So, they are terrifying.
Exactly.
Oh my God, Becky.
Look at her.
No, the Valley Girl thing.
Ah, yes.
But yes, that's what it could be, one possible place we were going.
Yeah, so I really see what happened here. We have Sloane, a character who was originally introduced as a side fun color character, shall we say.
I just want to punch everything.
And naturally enough, Mary Robinette Cowell gave her a Valley Girl accent because it seemed funny. And it was funny, and it worked really well in the first book. But now Sloan handles a good portion of the narration, which means that a good portion of this book is narrated in Valley Girl speak.
Yes.
And for consistency, Mary Robinette Cowell is keeping the Valley Girl accent going. Angry Valley Girl. And I'm wondering if she regrets that choice just a little bit.
It's like, if we knew in advance this would happen, then we might have modified it a bit. Yeah, that was the only thing that I did get used to it. But I sort of wish that she had backed off on the non-speaking parts when the internal monologue was, you know, maybe a little bit less Valley Girl. The thing is, I don't know how you would de-Valley Girl it and make it still sound like her, you know.
In the book, she actually did revert to like a different, what's the word I'm looking for here?
Well, there's the childhood sequence where she had a different accent.
Yeah, but it was kind of refreshing.
Yes. Well, then at one point it switches to third person narrating her, and so I think with some relief, Mary Robinette Cowell manages to drop the Valley Girl accent there.
Yes.
I really can't see a way out of it for Cowell because she wants to stay consistent with the previous book. And
right. There were a couple times where it made it confusing whether she was talking or whether she was having in like an internal monologue or a thought, which is happens in audio also. But
absolutely.
Yeah. The only thing I could imagine is she sort of would make it a little bit less emphatic, you know, when she isn't actually speaking. But yeah, like you said, she did keep it consistent.
Yeah. No way out. Sorry. I can't see any way. It was a choice that she made originally. And unfortunately, there's a lot of revelation about Sloane that she's very old, that she was born in when? The 1800s?
I think it was even before then.
Yeah, right. It was easily this
17th century or something.
1700s or 1600s.
Yeah, quite a long time ago. And so why she talks in a Valley Girl accent now is never really addressed, because I get the impression that Seanan MacGuire had no idea that Mary Robinette Cowell was going to go this way.
Well, and maybe she didn't know the backstory. Who knows? You know.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I don't think in any of the descriptive text anywhere that they actually said that she was from Southern California or that she is a Valley Girl. It was all sort of just implied through the
attitude.
Through the accent, right?
Right, exactly. I really liked what she did when it was in the first book, and I still like what she did. It just made some of it kind of slow going.
So I feel like I either miss some reference or maybe there just is no answer, where there's that part where we get to see early on, you know, Sloane had, I forget her original name as a child, but you know, she was something.
Amity Green.
Amity Green, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and they basically said, okay, you know, when you join this team, you have to give up your name and give up your family and so forth. And so they said, well, what, you know, what will your name be? And she just kind of immediately says Sloane. And I'm like, okay, is that a reference to something? You know, it just seems like a very sudden, you know.
Yeah, it's probably a deep reference that I'm not getting. It seems that, you know, Seanan MacGuire has really done her research here, and I think it's beyond my pitiful English major skills.
We have no hope then.
I'm disappointed in your English major foo now. Speaking of the background stuff, that was when I was kind of doing a little bit of research here. I didn't realize in the first book, and only just kind of stumbled upon the fact that the Arnon Thompson Index is a real thing.
Oh, it's all real.
Well, yes, that's where my brain goes. And it's like I was kind of thinking, okay, what archetype am I? Like
the Prince of Vagueness.
Shh.
Was bitten by a magical frog.
I'm going to go fully active if you don't shut up, Steve.
Please let me punch him now.
So right, the fact that they're, you know, on Wikipedia, they kind of go into the Arnon Thompson classification system, and it's like, you know, oh, you know, the tale types for brides and wives are 400 to 424, for like the quest for the lost bride is type 400, the animal bride 402.
Because TV tropes had to have a predecessor.
Right, and I guess it makes sense doing ethnographic research or whatever, where it's like, okay, we can classify these into these kind of general tropes or types, and it sort of was interesting that she was able to use that as a basis for this entire kind of narrative concept.
Right.
And I actually really enjoy that part.
And I think it's an interesting way of bringing in folk tales without implying the existence of a separate fairy world.
Right.
Fairy tales are currently really, really big. There are several TV shows, There's Fables by Bill Willingham.
Yeah, for about the past decade, I think it's really been on the rise. It's sort of hitting a crescendo right about now.
Yeah, it's the new ninjas, zombies, whatever.
Right.
Next up, steampunk Fable.
Beyond doubt. In most of these cases, we assume that Fairyland is somehow real and it's bleeding over into this one, whereas this one, Fairyland is more like Platonic idealism. In some ways, the narrative is just this powerful extra force in reality that can grab a hold of events and twist them into certain directions.
Right. I mean, it's sort of like personified Mother Nature of some kind or something, you know, where if you sort of give into it and or don't realize what's happening, it's easy to have it sort of like write your story for you to kind of force you to fit into this archetype of what it wants the story to be.
Mm-hmm. I'm not entirely sure if she's making a metaphor here for, you know, people's expectations of you or anything like that. She's just using it as a narrative conceit, although it seems to me like it should be a metaphor for something. I just can't figure out what.
Yeah, I was kind of just kicking around some ideas in my head. I'm not sure if I'm willing to share any of them because they might be quite stupid. But
and thus, everything that we say.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's, you know, because one of the things we all often bring up is like, okay, well, what did you think about the magic system since it's, you know, kind of a fantasy book? And, you know, so I guess the narrative really is kind of the magic system. The one thing I really liked about this book and the first book too was sort of how the narrative as the magic system sort of, you know, controls things. It kind of wants to gain more control over the world, but the characters are slowly learning how to make things happen by sort of utilizing the narrative to their advantage.
Well, the narrative itself has been codified by people, you know, in the real world, right? I mean, they basically have the ATU index, right? And I think it's the Mother Hubbard figure essentially learns to sort of like perform some sort of meta magic by, you know, basically updating the index, right? And changing people's narratives.
Right. And so it becomes natural for her to start collecting powerful figures and trying to put them to use as the central hub figure.
It also points out there's a magic system with meta magic, right? I mean,
right. That in fact, she sort of Sloane sort of talks about how when they do the retrospective section and they're just starting to codify the stuff, and she kind of says, "Are you sure you want to give the narrative this much power? You know, kind of by writing it all down, you kind of give it the power of maybe changing it all at the same time, and you're kind of giving it extra narrative weight by kind of giving it weight, like sort of this recursive thing or this meta thing.
Right. The index itself has become a powerful
artifact.
Artifact, exactly. Which makes me think about Warehouse 13, which this is kind of a little bit like in some ways.
It is a little warehousey, yeah.
Which to me is a good thing. I love Warehouse 13.
Yeah.
Yeah, and in fact, Barry and I were talking about how this, you know, does feel very RPG-like. You know, you're like, okay, roll up my character. Who are you? I'm a Snow White. You know, are you activated yet or whatever? And
I could totally see doing this as an RPG.
And yeah, and in fact, it sounds like it would be really cool to do it that way.
I think Seanan might do that.
Uh-oh, I'm already planning on doing it for the Saturday Night Game Garage. It's going to be a straight-up D&D 5 game with basically fate chips and narratives.
Sounds great. Invite Seanan.
Does she RPG?
I think she does. I'm not sure, actually. Like I said, friendly acquaintance.
Well, she LARPs.
That's true.
I think so, anyway. I'm going to use that with filking. Sorry.
She filks, okay. Not LARPs.
Okay.
Snip, snip, snip.
Snip, snip.
The hell is filking?
She filks, yes.
That's actually an honest question.
Yes. So, yeah, Seanan MacGuire is a known filk singer. A filk singer is like a folk singer, but sings about genre topics in science fiction and fantasy.
Ah, okay.
It comes from a typo in a program a long time ago where they originally planned to say folk singing will take place in the lobby, but instead said filk singing will take place in the lobby.
It's an honest mistake.
So, just like any other artifact in the narrative, it took on a life of its own.
Right. So it now has an entry.
There are now filk singing festivals.
Oh, God.
So one example that, you know, comes to mind is, you know, Sloane is running through the maze and, You know, she's sort of escaping from the Snow White that took over Henry's body. Sloane finally confronts her and she's like, you know, who the hell are you or whatever, when my horrible Valley Girl accent there. And, you know, finally, you know, Adrianna's kind of like, okay, now I can let down my pretense and just, you know, finally go on. And, you know, so she's trying to recruit Sloane. You know, Sloane's kind of playing along with it to try to see what she can do with it. And finally she's like, oh crap, you know, I'm kind of stuck here. And so she runs into the Marquis, I guess, you know, the one of the characters from the Puss in Boots.
Right. Marquis de Carabas.
Yes. And so she kind of figures she could do something by inserting herself into the narrative. So she kind of, you know, pretends that she's the cat. And the Marquis kind of is like, oh, you're the cat? Oh, okay. And then, you know, she kind of convinces him to help protect her a little bit. Then he, you know, very quickly he's killed. But then she realizes, like, well, he, being part of the narrative, recognized her as the cat, so she could sort of become the cat. And so she successfully kind of, you know, becomes very, like, not invisible literally, but she's able to hide kind of in plain sight and essentially become invisible by using the narrative power of that story.
That is interesting, because hiding in plain sight happens in a couple of places here.
Right, yes. So one of the sort of other places is the Whiteout Wood, where all the Snow Whites kind of live in this, like, meta location where they all, you know, the, and this was a very strong recurrent, you know, the blood on the snow, you know?
okay. Let's just do the repetitive chanting. Let's get it over with.
Blood on the snow.
Thank you.
Out of our systems.
And so they're kind of saying, you know, back in sort of the prehistory of the Snow White myth, it was the myth of sacrificing sort of like a young virgin from the town to make winter end and bring back the spring. And, you know, sort of in the mythology, you know, back then that was kind of a pre-religious thing that would happen. And that became the Snow White mythology, you know, over the generations. So this place where it's like always winter and in the forest and the snow, that's like where all the Snow Whites go after they die, basically, or after they're taken over by the narrative and become Snow Whites. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of them that go to sleep and never come out, they just sort of stay there.
Right. They elect to stay in the White Wood.
Right. They just don't want to come back and their bodies just go into a coma or something. And in fact, you know, I guess this is a spoiler even for the first book, but, you know, it does happen in this book too, is, you know, that was sort of like one of the sort of the very strong narrative moment in the first book too, was where Henry activates her story on purpose to sort of invoke the power of the narrative by biting into an apple. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, up until that point in the first book, she had been sort of in abeyance where she knew she was a Snow White, but she, you know, she would smell apples and stuff, but she just would never eat them because that would sort of activate her story.
Right.
And sort of like they were cornered and they're all going to die. And so she kind of did that as a last ditch effort to sort of save her team. And, you know, was able to sort of, you know, once that was activated, she could, like, you know, call the animals to, you know, come in this, you know, let them escape from this building that was boarded up and stuff. And
right.
Even before that though, you know, in her home, right, all the animals would sort of show up and, you know, bang into the windows trying to get in. And,
right.
You know, the hallway would turn into a field of flowers by accident.
Oh, that's right. And they had stuff where the archivist would look at, well, bring me the flowers from your living room, and that will help me, you know, kind of divine the future because that means something.
It's like reading tea leaves.
Yeah, basically.
Speaking of which, regular questions.
Was there tea?
I don't remember any.
I don't think there was.
Oh, weird.
Clearly a book that's on, you know, it's a deficient in some way then.
We'll have to ask Shannon about why no tea.
If we ever get to interview her and she does not, in fact, stab us to death before I can get the podcast posted.
I'll be working with this, you know, interview remotely then.
I'm not sure that that will help very much.
Damn.
The power of the narrative, Barry.
Next question, was there an awkward sex scene? No, we haven't had one of those in a while, in fact.
Kind of starting to miss it a little bit. However, I think our next book has one that's pretty early on, about 90 minutes in.
Well, or maybe it's even that.
Might even be a pre-sex scene, but it's still awkward.
Okay, well, that brings us to a close on the usual questions. So, did we want to talk about the LGBTQ element with Jerry and how it changed Henry's story?
Sure. So they spend about maybe 30 to 45 minutes talking about why Henrietta goes by Henry and her sister, you know, biological, you know, sister, but he is a transgender man. And this happens pretty early on in their childhood. And in sort of in solidarity, she takes on the name Henry. But this ends up breaking her narrative because Snow White is supposed to have sort of
it was a rose red, right?
Yeah, she was originally... Was she originally a rose red?
Well, no.
He was originally a rose red.
That's right. They come in pairs, right? Rose reds and Snow Whites come in pairs.
Right. So what's going on here is that there are originally two different stories. There was just Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. And then there was also a completely different story, Snow White and Rose Red. And since both of them have the name Snow White, then they tend to be sort of glommed together, even though basically it's just, the second one is just a story of kids lost in the forest, as far as I know.
Yeah, I've only ever seen the Disney version, so.
Right.
And then only read the Fables comic book version.
Right, and Fables has Rose Red and those, but I think that I first heard about Rose Red in Fables, so.
Yes, I believe that is true. That was my first exposure to Rose Red and the Snow White, you know, connection. But basically, this ends up breaking the narrative definition because they're both not female now.
Right. Also, she does not have any kind of snow in her name or anything regarding whiteness in it.
Yeah. In fact, I think there was even a portion of the book that was sort of dedicated to, you know, why are you named, you know, Henrietta? I would have named you, you know, all, you know, a long list of other names that, exactly. that mean white in other languages, which I thought was pretty amusing.
Yes.
Right. I don't think that was a necessity for the narrative, but it sort of preferred that, you know.
Right. The narrative probably would get her to change her name if it got really its hooks into her.
Right. Much like, what is it, the doctor and the... You know, Death's Godfather thing or whatever that was.
Death's Godson, I think.
Death's
it is.
Godson, yeah.
Oh, right. And it was, and he kind of went crazy, but it was sort of like, you know, you're just inviting that in when you name someone like that and like letting him be a doctor or whatever. Right.
It was a doctor named Mort.
Yeah. Mortimer, right?
Yes.
And it's like, this sounds very Discworldy, but.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I've certainly met a few doctors with names that I would not apply to doctors. I remember hearing about...
My nickname is Shakes.
Shakes the Clown.
So yeah, one thing too, towards the climax, Henry is returned in another Snow White's body, and she's coming back trying to fight, her body... occupied by you know who, Adriana.
Hey, wow! He remembered.
Ding, ding, ding.
I wrote it on the board behind me.
In invisible ink.
Yes. Kevin can see it. That's ambiguous.
That's true.
And so at this point, she kind of makes not a deal with the devil, but sort of a deal with her narrative, you know, the Snow White narrative, who says, well, why should I help you? You've been sort of rejecting me your whole life. And she's kind of like, well, I really need your help. And, you know, besides, I'll help you out. And so she kind of agrees that, you know, she'll stop fighting the narrative, or her story anyway.
Right. To go to the alternate version of the Arne Thompson classification, this is the classic problem of the TV troupe's omnicidal maniac. How does the omnicidal maniac who literally wants to destroy the world get allies who then would be destroyed?
Well, she sort of spends a lot of this book sort of hurtling towards this decision, right? You know,
right.
At some point she realizes, you know, she's in the director's office and they're talking to her about how the escape at the prison was really more than it really was, mm-hmm. you know, that they initially thought. It wasn't just, you know, one person escaping. It was a number of people escaping, you know, and she starts to like lose control over her own narrative. It starts snowing in the room and, you
right.
know.
I mean... True to form, this all feels like it should be a metaphor for something, but I'm hesitant to say what it might possibly be. I mean, you know, it's tempting to say, oh, it's a metaphor for LGBTQ and, you know, accepting your essential nature, but that doesn't seem right because they're fighting against the narrative and that seems good. And it's maybe just sort of accepting your individuality is good and don't try to be, you know, swept away by overarching narratives might be a decent moral, but I'm pretty sure that I'm just being an idiot trying to find a moral in this thing.
Well, come on, like Mark Twain said, this doesn't mean nothing.
Yeah, exactly. What was it? Those finding a moral in it will be shot or something like that?
Something along those lines. I don't remember the wording, but I remember from eighth grade reading something and they said, well, what's the meaning of the story? And I found that in the like the beginning. I said, it doesn't mean anything. It says right here. Anyway, so yeah, well, there were parts earlier where she's kind of, you know, goes deeper into like the treatment of the people who are sort of taken over by the narrative through no fault of their own.
Right.
And then they're just sort of thrown into prison. So there's definitely seems to be this theme of, okay, you know, this might, you know, we don't know how to deal with it, but this probably isn't the best way. And,
right.
And so it seemed like she's going, you know, Henry's going towards this thought of, okay, well, we need to sort of revise, you know, how we're dealing with it. And so that's kind of, you know, I'm feeling, you know, maybe I'm just making this up, but I'm feeling like maybe that's pointing towards like, you know, where the series may go of, you know,
prison reform.
Well, yeah, prison reform, but, you know, kind of like this meta, you know, coming to terms with the narrative and not really like a combative nature of like the ATI or the world versus the narrative. It's kind of like coming to terms with the narrative and kind of like embracing it. And maybe that will change the nature of it in some way.
It is interesting because we have Sierra, who is a Bluebeard's wife archetype and has actually married a Bluebeard and basically just knows that she has to keep herself from opening the door to the garage or else her husband will kill her.
It's your fault if I do it.
And she actually has been able to keep herself managed in this way. It's almost like it's a mental illness.
Well, actually, that is, you know, that reminds me of that was kind of what I was thinking in the first part of the book, where there were definitely parts that felt like people dealing with mental illness, like themselves, like dealing with their story was kind of like dealing with certain kinds of mental illness and kind of like trying to keep a handle on it or something. And I don't know if that was meant explicitly or not either, but there's that thought definitely came up.
I think you can see a parallel there, whether or not it was intended.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of these cases in the book where something is sort of foisted upon somebody, like, you know, like a Bluebeard's wife, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like Sierra, you know, it's like, I think she at one point she kind of described it as sort of like a gnawing in the back of her mind, you know, and it's, you know, I often hear that same statement with people who have like a mental illness.
Sure.
Right. It's like there's some sort of something that's sort of compelling them or, you know, reminding them constantly of it.
Right. And they can keep it at bay if they can keep themselves managed, just like she does. She has one of those charms. I forget exactly what it was, but for going into the prison. But also that seemed to be related to her being able to keep from falling too far into her archetype.
Mm-hmm.
Because once she gives that charm to Henry, then she basically has to tell someone to just guard her and keep her from going home. Where
she's immediately like, I said I'd be home, meet my husband, let me go home. And she's like, yeah, no.
So, yeah, I think that there's an interesting parallel there.
But they also do spend like quite a bit of time, you know, using their own narrative to fix problems, right?
Yeah.
Especially like Sierra, where she, you know, they need to have something unlocked. You know, she's like, she could just sort of whisper into the lock and, you know, sort of, you know, for lack of a better word, sort of just, you know, mold it and caress it into, you know, opening without really too much difficulty.
Right. Or as they put it, were you flirting with that hedge? Yeah. I think it was.
Yes. I think they were, are you seducing that hedge?
Yeah.
Well, it's special seduce hedge fanfic or slash fic, maybe.
Oh, I'm quite sure that there are some readers that were very fascinated by that narrative.
The ATU is a player's handbook with the magic guide. They're like, well, what could I do to get this done?
Mm-hmm.
I did enjoy the fact that the prison turned out to be anchored as a beanstalk. And, you know, like we were talking about earlier, you know, sort of hidden in plain sight, you know, normal people, you know, they look at it, they can't even process it. So it just goes right past them. Right. And the way they get into this, you know, the prison parking lot is basically, you know, driving off Dead Man's Cliff, just kind of interesting. You know, they all get sort of violently sick as they pass through the, you know, magic field, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. So that's it for this exciting episode. If you like this podcast or even feel neutral in a non-negative way, we'd appreciate a 5-star review on iTunes. You can also give us a like on our Facebook page where you can find out about upcoming episodes. Our theme song is Love Amplifier by Safe Word, available on Magnatune. And until next time, we are Sci-Fi.
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 Yeah.
Sci-Fi.
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 Best episode.